Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
The following program was pre-recorded, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station or its management.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Get ready to take notes, because school is now in session. Tackling the biggest issues in education, this is Education America. Save the classroom, save the country. Here are your hosts, Headmaster Rebecca Hagstrom and co-host Mark Durkin.
Hey, teacher, leave them kids alone.
And welcome to Education America, where we are taking steps to save the classroom so that we can save the country. Come along with us every Saturday night here on AM 1280 The Patriot. K-12 education is the playing field. And as the 16th President Abraham Lincoln so rightly stated, he said the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of government in the next. I'm Mark Durkin, and again, I'm joined by my co-host and founder of Liberty Classical Academy, Rebecca Hagstrom. Good to see you again.
Good to see you again.
Absolutely.
Another exciting show.
And we're in the month of October already.
I know.
The time's flying.
It's just so fast.
It is.
I can't believe how fast it goes.
Absolutely. Well, we have been speaking quite a bit over the last year of the basis of critical race theory and how it's an attempt to forever link racial identity with America's history. And while its advocates argue that CRT interprets how racism is embedded in our institutions, school families here in Minnesota and across the country are taking notice of how the free exchange of ideas in the classroom, they're being eradicated. So our guest tonight joins us again, and she's here to tell us that when schools teach racial equity, kids, they're learning fear and anger.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. And joining us again in studio tonight to address the dangers associated with the nation's K-12 schools approach to equity is Catherine Kirsten. Catherine is a senior policy fellow at the Center of the American Experiment. And she's also a writer, attorney, and has served as a Metro columnist for the Star Tribune from 2005 to 2008. She has also served as an opinion columnist for the paper between 1996 and 2013. Catherine was a founding director of the Center of the American Experiment and served as its chair from 1996 to 1998. Catherine, we're so glad to have you back. Thank you again for joining us here on Education America.
It's great to be with you.
Well, we're going to jump right in to this book. The authors of the book, Coddling of the American Mind, they cite an ongoing cult of safetyism as a major reason for the growing mental health crisis. Can you explain for us what that means?
The cult of safetyism, yes. It comes down to one of what they call the three great untruths that promote this worldview. And that is that children are fragile. Children are incredibly fragile. Their lives can be blighted by the smallest things that cause them any kind of concern or that challenge them in ways that make them uncomfortable. For example, going to a school that is named after Alexander Ramsey, the first territorial governor here in Minnesota, you know, some Native American activist now, you know, say he was a bad man, but that going to that school or reading a Dr. Seuss book that some people might regard as racist, that these are challenges that can debilitate young people, and they must be protected from this and anything else of the kind that makes them uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think back to actually when we first did our show, I think 6 years ago was when our show began. It was just becoming a fad for colleges to have safe spaces. And that was the first time I had heard this notion of safetyism, even though I had been sensing it for a long time. Like I said on last week's show, Susanna Hoff Sommer's book came out over 20 years ago, I believe, and she really pointed to a lot of that then. But do you think that this notion of safetyism has kind of grown out of the colleges really initiating that? Or where do you think that this really originated from? I'm kind of throwing this question at you out of left field. Sorry.
a huge topic. I think, yes, I mean, almost everything bad in my view today is coming from higher education.
Yeah.
You know, supposedly the smartest people who lack common sense in, you know, shocking ways. But, you know, I think a major source of this is the growth of the therapeutic culture and mindset that life is about nothing more than feeling good. And sort of getting what you want, easy life. I mean, the notion of sin, for example, is just anathema in the therapeutic mindset. The idea that you might be challenged, that you might change your ways. No. You know, that totally upsets your equilibrium. And the purpose of life is defeated if you ever feel bad about anything.
Yeah.
Not realistic, we might say.
Right, not realistic. But that is, I'm so glad that you mentioned all of these things, because I do think people wonder, where did this come from? Even as some of us, I think all parents are guilty of some of this at some point in their lives with their children, trying to protect them from the evils of the world. But it is interesting to look at where this originated, and you're right. The higher education piece has a large role to play in how we ended up where we did today.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the fact that there were these three great untruths that the author cited, and that you kind of talked about the first truth already, the truth of, I think fragility is the very first truth. Is that right? Is that the first one?
Fragility is the first truth in the book, yeah.
Yes, okay. And they talk a little bit about how life is a battle between good people and evil people.
Right.
And you didn't really touch on that piece of it. What I remember from the book is they mentioned how that dichotomy, it seems, is purposed so much in our culture today that there's no in between, that people have to be viewed as either they're on the good side, the right side, or they're bad and they're on the wrong side.
Yes.
And there's no in between. And
right.
That notion, you know, think about, maybe you could comment on that really quick as to what that does then to our culture. If there's really only one right, one wrong, and there's nothing in between, what does that do?
Well, of course, this is the fundamentally culturally Marxist idea. It is the fundamental tenet of Marxism that there are the oppressors and there are the oppressed. So, you know, human life revolves around that dichotomy. And of course, the people pushing this, but they're the good guys. Mm-hmm. The rest of us are victims of false consciousness, bad guys, et cetera. But Haidt and Lukianoff I think have such an interesting take on that, because they say that although this is supposedly about improving racial harmony and all, it has the opposite effect. They say, and I'm quoting here, if someone wanted to create an environment of perpetual anger and intergroup conflict, this would be an effective way to do it. And they point to brain science, and they talk about how human beings are hardwired for an us versus them mentality, for kind of tribalism. It just kind of survival over thousands of years. And what they say is that this equity theory activates the tribal switch that all of us have, and creates and heightens these intergroup tensions. It just puts such pressure on people to dehumanize opposing groups. I mean, just think about World War II. You know, immediately people move toward the notion of the Huns, and you know, you see these people with evil sneers and horns on their hem. That's what we do in order to help us fight more effectively. We simplify in that way. Yeah. And what Haidt and Lukianoff are saying is this is happening in our schools and in our culture now on so many levels.
Yeah. Yeah, so well said.
Let's pivot here just a little bit to the second great untruth that the authors cite, and that's the emotional reasoning piece of this. Never question your feelings. You know, what's an example of this great untruth, and what are the dangers associated with negative emotions if they're not, as you say, not subjected to reasoned analysis?
Well, this would flow from the therapeutic culture that we're now engulfed in. I think it's everything is about feeling. Nothing is about thinking. You are a good person if you are, quote, committed to, a political activism of some kind. It doesn't matter what it is.
Right, whether it's right or wrong.
Whether it's right or wrong. So this idea is that instead of asking kids who might feel personally threatened by someone whose views are different, instead of asking them to sit down and logically work through the pros and cons of the various ideas that are being put forward, quite the opposite is being urged on kids. They should go with their gut feelings, whatever emotions they might feel, and they're being coached, by the way, that anything that differs from their supposed worldview is a direct threat to their identity. Mm-hmm. But what the authors say, and I had never really thought about this, they bring in, again, sort of social psychology and brain science, and they say that when you teach children to view the world entirely through their feelings, you are amping up what they call cognitive distortions in the way these kids' minds work. They say feelings are not a reliable guide to reality. Mm-hmm. So when you create these cognitive distortions, there are things like negative filtering. That means training your mind to only focus on the bad things, or what they call hostile attribution bias, where you see hostile motives where there are none. Mm-hmm. So, again, the world is completely black and white in terms of simple and one-dimensional, and we completely miss the richness and complexity of human life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then there's a third great untruth that we touched on briefly earlier on and that you've written extensively about, and that is young people are so fragile that they must be sheltered from any experience that feels emotionally unsafe. We touched on this a little bit on the fragility piece. Is there anything more you can add to that?
Well, one thing I thought was so interesting here, again, this is the kind of social science that they bring into this debate. They start out talking about peanut allergies, right,
oh,
Rebecca?
Yes, I remember this story, yes.
Such a fascinating thing.
Yes.
You see that, 25 years ago, doctors were saying, well, we have to keep kids, little kids, 2-3-year-old kids, from peanuts because we have to make sure they don't, that they're not endangered, at this young age by what could become an allergy. Well, this actually had the opposite effect. Scientists found that kids were shielded from any exposure to peanuts, actually were much more likely to develop peanut allergies because they didn't their systems weren't accustomed to dealing with this potential outside threat, and so they become more vulnerable. So I thought that was just such an interesting intro, because what they're really saying is kids' muscles need challenges and stressors. That's why, football players do push-ups, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It makes you stronger. It doesn't make you weaker. So that's what they're saying. We are withholding these kinds of stressors and challenges that make us stronger from our kids, and as a result, they are becoming weaker and more fearful and less resilient, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was a great opening story as well. And it was interesting because, you know, again, as a school leader, it's true. Like when I was young, growing up, I don't remember ever hearing about peanut allergies. You know, we had peanut butter in schools all the time. And
right.
And now as a school leader, you know, we don't have a lot of kids with peanut allergies, but we do have a few. And I hadn't ever considered that that was maybe how it had originated. And they're saying that now as people are reintroducing it a little bit more, that the number of allergies are actually going down.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, well, what damage, Catherine, do you think will come to children? And we're actually already seeing some of this. Who are taught that failures, insults, and painful experiences will produce lasting damage in their lives?
Well, you know, this is related to what we have just talked about. You just think about what I used to hear, and I'm sure what you used to hear from your parents when you were young, when someone said a mean thing to you, this notion of sticks and stones can break my bones,
right.
But words can never hurt me. You grow stronger. You don't acquiesce in handing power over your mental state to some third person if you can look at the world that way.
Mm-hmm.
These racial equity programs, the cult of safetyism generally, do exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So the result, say these authors, is that keeping kids in a fragile kind of state of mind actually renders them much more easily hurt, you know, unreasonably fearful of the world and unable to take control or to take responsibility for their own behaviors and seeing themselves as victims. And what a terrible way to create a helpless adult.
Yeah. Oh, that is such a good point, Catherine. And we wonder why we're seeing anxiety on the rise amongst our nation's children. And so not only, though, is anxiety a result of this, but I like how you talk about the lack of control over their own world that gives them.
Yeah.
If they're in such a state of fragility.
And here's a wonderful kind of way to understand that. Viktor Frankl was a Nazi. He was placed in a concentration camp during the Second World War. He was a psychiatrist, as I recall, and he said that he realized in the concentration camp that the most important kind of intellectual and mental spiritual tool that we have is that we can decide how we are going to react to a situation, especially a terrible situation like this.
Yeah.
So he felt that he had this power over his own mental state in his life as a concentration camp inmate because he could stand outside of it. He had this kind of self-control and self-awareness. That's exactly what we are keeping our kids from developing. We are telling them that if somebody, you know, it has a microaggression against you, oh my gosh, your life is over. You know, you got to sue, you collapse, you have to have, you know, the vapors to revive your fainting spirit. That's ridiculous, but that's exactly how we are hobbling our kids today.
And the other thing that I've noticed just in watching some of the videos of, you've probably seen them yourself, you know, on Twitter, of people who videotape situations. I just saw one last night, actually. That's why it's fresh on my mind, of two white young college students studying in a multicultural center, and two other, I don't know the race of those that were approaching them, but two women who came and just started railing on them because one of them had a sticker on his computer saying, "Police lives matter." And, well, she must have been black because she said, "That's such an offense to me, you know, because police lives don't matter. And, you know, they're oppressive to me." And anyway, these people were so angry and so mean to these two young men.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they said, well, if it's a multicultural space and, you know, white is a culture too, and they yelled back, you think white is a culture? White is not a culture. Yeah. And, you know, I just thought anger is another thing that comes from this.
Oh, true.
It's, you know, it's not just anxiety and a lack of control, but it is anger. It's just becoming such an angry culture. It's just really hard to watch.
Yes, you are exactly right. And that's one of the many inconsistencies here. You know, people pushing this stuff like to hold themselves out as compassionate, empathetic. No, you know,
it's the opposite.
At least, you know, the people running the show are stoking anger. They are filled with resentment. Mm-hmm. They accuse people who oppose them of, quote, hate. You know, if we want to see hatred, I think we can look at some of the masterminds of these racial equity programs.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's pivot for a moment here, Catherine. Let's put this book now in the hands of school teachers. What could they take away from this book?
Well, I think this is, you know, comes straight from one of the lines in the book. The authors say to teachers, quote, if you encourage students to find more things offensive, leading them to experience more negative impacts, and you also tell them that whoever says or does things they find offensive is an aggressor who's committed acts of bigotry, you are fostering feelings of victimization, anger, and hopelessness in your students. You are setting them up for a life of self-doubt and misery, rather than, you know, empowerment and racial harmony, which is what we're told this is all about.
Yeah, that is a great statement from that book. Boy, it's so true. And I hope we can, you know, almost makes you want to, you know, send a copy of this book to every teacher friend that you know and asking them to take the time to read it.
That's what our recovering wokester recommended.
Is it really? Oh, my goodness. Yeah. That's great. That's great. Well, our listeners can think about that. If you have teachers in your family that support this whole racial equity theory, you know, consider sending them this book. Yeah, good point. Well, the education of our children does begin at home. What constructive things should parents be teaching the young people that then maybe hopefully schools can tie in with rather than contradicting them?
Well, when you say that, my first thought is the golden rule.
Yeah, there
you
go.
Know, all of this could be tossed aside if parents and schools would simply teach that we should do unto others as we would have done unto us. Don't divide children or adults into racial groups or intersectional whatevers, but treat all people with dignity. Look at everyone as an individual, and then understand your responsibility for your behavior, choosing between right and wrong, and expect the same of others. Because that one thing that's missing in this whole worldview is the notion of personal responsibility.
Right.
Nobody's personally responsible, because if you're black, you're determined to be a victim. If you're white, you're determined to be an oppressor. There's no room for free will.
Exactly.
It's just realism.
It is.
And even in the process of not being treated as you would like to be treated, we still have a responsibility in terms of how we react, because much of this is reactionary driven.
Exactly.
That is so true. But, you know, to Catherine's point, I don't know that our schools are teaching the golden rule anymore. You know, that was
definitely
a statement
not
that Jesus made. And, you know, back in 62 and 63, when we removed prayer and Bible reading from our nation's public schools, slowly but surely, a lot of those remnants were eliminated.
And now you've got teachers over the decades doing what's right in their own eyes, and this is what it has produced.
Or not even using the terms good and evil, right and wrong.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure, Rebecca, as a school head, you know that so often we hear today, don't do that, that is not appropriate.
Yes.
No, that's wrong.
Right.
How confusing to kids.
Yes, it's very confusing. I have actually talked to our teachers about that over the course of the years, to when you correct a child that's not being kind to someone, don't use the word nice. You know, don't do that because it's not nice. I'd rather hear you say, please don't treat your friend that way because it's not kind. And Jesus calls us to treat others the way you want to be treated yourself. So to finish the statement so that they know, and, you know, our body of values reflects the golden rule. And thankfully, our teachers are great about helping our students understand that.
To love your neighbor as you love yourself.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, as we've discussed, Catherine, with you much over the last year, this obviously has all its roots in critical race theory. There are so many branches that come straight off of this vine, unfortunately. When it comes to CRT, what are the five most concerning facts that families need to know about this theory?
Well, this is a good segue into recommending a website called RejectCRT.org, which is the creation of Californians for Equal Rights Foundation. Mm-hmm. These are the people, you know, fighting basically CRT and the whole notion behind affirmative action, treating people differently simply on the basis of their skin color. So what they list is, number one, critical race theory is against equality and for illegal race-based discrimination. Mm-hmm. Number two, critical race theory is against capitalism and for socialism. Mm-hmm. And they back each one of these up with quotations from founders of critical race theory. Mm-hmm. Their third point is critical race theory is against traditional American values based on Marxism, that is the cultural variety. Mm-hmm. Number four, CRT is against teaching children that America is great. Mm-hmm. And four, un-American illiberal values. And number five, CRT is against personal empowerment. And four, victimhood and disempowerment, just what we were talking about a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
Those are five things.
Mm-hmm. And they are the undoing of our country if they're successful.
Yeah.
You know, they really are. Yes. I noticed that they've got a quote from a man who came out of communist China, and he's so fearful. He recognizes what is happening here as what was happening during the Cultural Revolution.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're running out of time here, but I want you to also address for our listeners from that same website, they talk about what families should be looking for and listening for in order to identify critical race theory, because if you ask a school directly if they're teaching it, they'll say no, usually.
Yeah.
So what are some of the terms that they should be listening for?
Well, here are a few things. They say race and racism are usually front and center in these practices. Mm-hmm. Okay. Secondly, they say that kids are told that most of the bad things happening in our society are a result of institutional or systemic racism.
Okay.
And they're also called to engage in action, activism, in order to dismantle racism. And they make the very good point, this stuff masquerades under many names. So when you hear diversity, equity, and inclusion, when you hear anti-racism, when you hear, you know, racial sensitivity training, or even social-emotional learning, anti-bias, culturally responsive practices, critical pedagogy, all of these are names that are used by people peddling this worldview.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that we ended on this point, because those terms that you just listed, they're everywhere. And it shows you how pervasive this critical theory has become. Catherine, thank you for joining us these last 2 weeks. We always enjoy having you on.
Yes, Catherine, thank you so
much. You're excellent, and you're always well-read and well-researched, and we're just so appreciative. And we know you're going on a wonderful trip to Europe for the next 3 weeks. You enjoy that trip. You deserve
Thanks
it.
So much.
All right.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, good to be with you. And thank you to our listeners. If you want to listen to this podcast or any other podcast, please go to savetheclassroom.com, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Have a great night. See you next week.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy.